Deval Patrick is leaving the Clinton administration with a sense of accomplishment, he says. As the outgoing Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, he is proud of many things that were done at the Justice Department during the past 3 years, bringing more suits than ever before against discrimination in lending, launching a task force to combat the wave of arsons at black churches, challenging the all-male admissions policies at the Citadel and the Virginia Military Institute. He is also credited with helping fashion the administration's stand on affirmative action, mend it, don't end it. And this season, as he prepares to leave Washington, time may be on the side of the enders rather than the menders. California voters have approved Proposition 209, which outlaws racial preferences. For Deval Patrick, who is black and grew up poor in Chicago and was tapped for a prep school scholarship program that led him to Harvard, that is a troubling development.
I am worried about the California initiative because I think to the extent that it purports to prohibit discrimination, it adds nothing to existing law. To the extent, frankly, it purports to prohibit quotas, it adds nothing to existing law. What it really does is ban efforts largely undertaken voluntarily to integrate American institutions. And I hope that we are not getting to a point where we are going to be, in essence, asking the majority for how much freedom the minority can have or should have. Mm-hmm.
But in the case of California, say, the University of California system says that evidently the current system involves admitting far fewer Asian applicants than would qualify but for a system of preferences to other minority groups. Doesn't it advance some concept of civil rights to say that every Asian high school senior applying has an equal chance of admission to the system?
Yes. As a matter of theory, it ought to. And clearly, merit has to predominate. The question is, what is merit? And is there an educational value to having a diverse student body? I think that is an issue that educators have spoken to and they have talked about. And frankly, from my own experience, I know that I learned a great deal about tolerance and respect for people who were different than I by being around people who were different than I. And that was an experience I got in school. So I think the value is important. No one is saying that every affirmative action plan is the right plan or the right way to go about it. That needs to be examined. So I say fix the problem and respect and save the principle.
There is an idea that seems to be bubbling up as a way of satisfying the aims of Proposition 209 and yet also maintaining diversity, which is to, in effect, redefine diversity in terms of giving a boost to people whose socioeconomic circumstances disadvantage them, rather than people who simply by belonging to a minority group are presumed to be disadvantaged. Mm-hmm. Do you accept that distinction, and is it one that can become part of civil rights law?
I like the idea of giving an extra hand to people who are economically disadvantaged. I think that is a terrific idea. I think you've seen the president respond to that idea in a variety of ways, most notably trying to make educational scholarships available to people who need that kind of financial break. That's terrific. I'm not convinced it's a substitute for racial and ethnic diversity or for the inclusion affirmatively of women in programs that have historically excluded people like that. I mean, the point to remember about affirmative action is that it was never designed as an anti-poverty program. It was designed as an integration tool. And historically and currently, we still have issues around discrimination in this country, and affirmative action has proven itself a tool that works in some contexts and under the right circumstances to make it possible to include people of talent from all American communities. So I'd like to see emphasis placed on including and expanding opportunities for poor people and people from disadvantaged educational backgrounds, no question about that. But I'm not convinced that that is a viable substitute for affirmative action.
Well, can you imagine it substituting to the extent that the children of a generation that has benefited from affirmative action programs, but who now are growing up, as I assume your children are, the children of a secure, prosperous middle class, that they should not be beneficiaries of such programs in the future?
I understand that theory. I guess I'd be more comfortable with supporting that if I were convinced that my children's membership in the middle class was going to insulate them from discrimination. I don't see the evidence of that necessarily. I certainly see that, you know, my ability to pick up the phone and call this person or that person, or to use my having graduated from this institution or that one as some currency to help my kids is perhaps to their advantage. But I'm not convinced, based on all the evidence that comes across my desk and my own life experience, that we have yet at this point crossed over to the point where race and ethnicity and gender does not matter at all in the eyes and minds of the decision makers in making decisions about what opportunities should be available to people.
Are you at all encouraged by the results of the past election, which were not generally encouraging for Democrats in Congress, but they actually were pretty encouraging for members of the Congressional Black Caucus, despite the fears that were raised about them running in districts that were redesigned to no longer have a guaranteed black majorities?
Of course, sure. You know, I've always believed that this notion of a majority-minority district should never be such that we should draw a district of that kind any place we can draw one. We have argued that it is within a state legislature's right to respond with that kind of remedy to a situation where the politics are already polarized. I think what you saw mainly in the success of some of the candidates who were running was the power of incumbency, which really proves the point, in a way, of affirmative action, which is that if you make it possible to expose the talents of minorities, then people will find their way to each other across these differences.
You are, however, describing a situation of some progress, and also when you talked about issues of discrimination against children raised in the black middle class, you detect progress. What would be the signs of saying that actually we've achieved a situation that is sufficient progress, that there need not be such special intervention?
Well, first of all, let me say I have complete faith that we as a country will get there one day. I think as long as we continue to turn back to American ideals of equality, opportunity, and fair play, and to strive toward those goals, in fact, as well as in theory, that we will continue to make progress. And I think we've made incredible progress over the last 30 or 40 years. It has to be acknowledged and celebrated.
But how will we know that we've actually gotten to something that is close enough to that point that we can feel that it's time to talk about colorblindness, in your view?
I think that the short answer is we'll know it when we see it. And that we're not quite there yet.
But what's the long answer then?
I think the longer answer is that we'll know when we have a sense that on its own, fair results and a sense of inclusion and a confidence in all American communities about fair play prevails. And some of those don't lend themselves to statistical measures. Some of those lend themselves to a mood and an attitude, a more universal condemnation of the mean-spiritedness that occasionally bubbles up in some American communities about the way other Americans are treated or mistreated. But I do think we will get there one day, and I think that there is not consensus on that view today.
When you were named to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, it was right after the disaster over the nomination of Lonnie Guinier. And at around that time, people were saying that it isn't even worth it to be named to a political position anymore in Washington, that you get put through the ringer in confirmation. If there was somebody who mowed the lawn and you didn't do the paperwork 6 years ago, you're going to have to account to that before a Senate committee, and you'll be let hang in the wind, indeed, if you get into difficulties. Is this an experience you recommend to others?
Despite all that, I recommend it to others and recommend it highly, because I have the great blessing of being able to say that I have not had a dull day in the 3 years I have been on the job. And although there is a certain amount of shenanigans that go with a job like this and the political discourse that swirls around a job like this, at the end of the day, I have been able to work with some of the most dedicated and talented people I have ever known, and on behalf of some of the most deserving Americans that you can imagine, and that is a tremendously uplifting experience.
Well, Deval Patrick, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Robert.
Deval Patrick has been Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights for the past 3 years. He is leaving that post and Washington in January.